Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, October 8th. Let's start with the front page. We have a scary photo of Daniela Louie, 16, who keeps an interesting bedroom in a haunted house in Downs. Our first article is about Halloween 2025. Harrowing Haunts. From Kelsey Watznauer at lee.net. Catch a scare at one of Central Illinois' haunted houses. Spooky season has returned to Central Illinois, complete with dark, winding trails, haunted asylums, creaky houses stocked with moaning monsters and zombies resurrected for a night of screams. Whether you seek a lights-out fear fest, a tour of the most haunted sites in the state capital, the chance to catch a killer or a family-friendly hayrack ride, Central Illinois has enough haunted attractions to fuel your fear throughout October into the Hallow weekend. For the complete county listing of haunted houses and attractions, please see the printed edition of the Decatur Herald and Review, page A6. We'll let you know about Champaign County. We have Necrosis Haunted House, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, closed October 5th. 1315 Enterprise Drive, Rantoul. Special events are Lights Out Night, 7:30 to 11:30 p.m. November 1st. And tickets are $25 to $35, available online and on-site at 217fear.com. In Macon County, we have Isabella's Curse, 7 to 11 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays, 2121 South Imboden Court, Decatur, $18 to $30, available online and on-site, isabellascurse.com. Back to our front page from Tony Reed in Decatur. City delays 24/7 daycare agreement. The Decatur City Council is still playing around with the prospect of sinking up to another $400,000 of taxpayers' money into birthing the dream of creating a 24-hour child care facility. An agreement had been all ready to sign at Monday evening's council meeting after previous delays with the private owners of the planned Love Learning and Laughter Daycare. But the final decision on whether to go ahead with the agreement was put off until the October 20th council meeting after a 7-0 unanimous vote. Council members had previously raised questions about wanting to see a detailed business plan for LLLD amid other worries about how much the project is costing and has already cost. The rehabilitation price for resurrecting the defunct Wee Folk Child Care Building on the corner of North Jasper and Orchard Streets has already burned a $1 million plus hole in taxpayers' pockets. That cost had ballooned more than $700,000 over the original purchase and rehabilitation estimate of $280,000. City Manager Tim Gleason said he understood council members' concerns and said he would be meeting Tuesday with representatives of LLLD to go over the agreement. He said with taxpayers making a total investment of more than $1 million, the city had to be careful. It's about making sure that with the city investment at $1.5 to $1.6 million, that we've got all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, Gleason told the council. I prefer to keep this very positive and work towards something the council considered. Attorney Ross J. Munsterman, representing LLLD and the business owner Sherry Johnson, said everyone wanted to make sure the council was satisfied and confident the new venture would succeed. And we felt that it would be best for us to meet in person to address those concerns, Munsterman said, referring to Tuesday's meeting with the city. He told council members that he wants Gleason to be able to come back to them and say, I've had all my questions answered, and I recommend, hopefully, that this will be approved. The tabled agreement with LLLD strictly limits future costs to the city to the $400,000 figure. Anything over that amount needed to fix up the building will be down to LLLD, and if that is a bridge too far, LLLD has the option to bail out. And the child care company, which gets to buy the building for a token $10, isn't obliged to begin 24/7 child care operations right away. Instead, it pledges that within 2 years of the agreement's closing date, it will open the child care facility with 1 8-hour shift for 51 weeks a year. After that, and within 1 year of the opening date, it will have the capacity to accept 170 children before bumping the total to 500 kids no later than 2 years after the opening date. And then, finally, within 2 years of the opening date, the agreement with the city says it will staff 3 8-hour shifts for round-the-clock care for a minimum of 51 weeks a year. That's always been the ultimate goal counselors had in mind in a city full of 24/7 manufacturing jobs, and the reason they had been willing to sink money into the project in the first place. But that willingness had begun to sour as costs escalated with a building that required major upgrades in everything from HVAC and sprinkler systems to flooring and even window frames. Gleason has accused former city administrators of failing to fully inform council members of the spiraling costs they were letting taxpayers in for. But Gleason now says it makes better financial sense to try and get the new facility up and running rather than walk away and see it abandoned. In other business, and looking at the city's own finances, its general fund is running $1.143 million over budget, with revenues up 3.4% at $3.3 million, but expenses trumping that with a rise of $3.8 million, or 4%. A report to this council showed key expense drivers were increased health care costs of $1 million, fueled by soaring high dollar claims, while police fire pensions jumped $1.2 million, along with costs for new equipment like fire service vehicles. The 2026 financial year recommended budget from interim city treasurer and director of finance Greg Zantara, now being considered by council, suggests increasing total property tax revenue by the same percentage that Decatur's property value has increased. The city's tax rate would remain flat, and at the median home value of $142,500, the increase in the levy works out at an additional $498 for the city's share of property taxes. Our last article from the front page from Christine Fernando, Associated Press in Chicago. Military intervention. Illinois braces for troops. Leaders await Trump's move, court ruling. Officials in Illinois braced Tuesday for the possible arrival of the National Guard, while a legal challenge to President Donald Trump's plan to send hundreds of troops to the Chicago area simmers, and critics vigorously pan the deployment of an assault on the city. Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, has said some 300 of the state's Guard troops were to be federalized and sent to Chicago, along with 400 from Texas. Pritzker accused Trump of using troops as political props and pawns. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson told reporters that the administration isn't sharing much information with the city. That is what is so difficult about this moment. You have an administration that is refusing to cooperate with a local authority, Johnson said Tuesday. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott on Monday posted a picture on social media showing Texas National Guard members boarding a plane, but he didn't specify where they were going. A federal judge gave the Trump administration 2 days to respond to a lawsuit filed Monday by Illinois and Chicago challenging the plan. A hearing is scheduled for Thursday. The lawsuit says these advances in President Trump's long-declared war on Chicago and Illinois are unlawful and dangerous. Trump's bid to deploy the military on U.S. soil over local opposition has triggered a conflict with blue state governors. In Oregon, a judge over the weekend blocked the Guard's deployment to Portland. The Trump administration has portrayed the cities as war-ravaged and lawless amid its crackdown on illegal immigration. Officials in Illinois and Oregon, however, say military intervention isn't needed and that federal involvement is inflaming the situation. Trump has said he would be willing to invoke the Insurrection Act if necessary. It allows the president to dispatch active-duty military in states that are unable to put down an insurrection or are defying federal law. If I had to enact it, I'd do that, Trump said Monday. If people were being killed and courts were holding us up or governors or mayors were holding us up, the sight of armed Border Patrol agents making arrests near famous landmarks has amplified concerns from Chicagoans already uneasy after an immigration crackdown that began last month. Agents have targeted immigrant-heavy and largely Latino areas. The Chicago mayor signed an executive order Monday barring federal immigration agents and others from using city-owned property, such as parking lots, garages, vacant lots, as staging areas for enforcement operations. Separately, the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois is also suing the federal government, accusing it of unleashing a campaign of violence against peaceful protesters and journalists during weeks of demonstrations outside a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building in suburban Broadview. Department of Homeland Security spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin said in response to the lawsuit that the First Amendment doesn't protect rioting. In Oregon, the Portland ICE facility has been the site of nightly protests for months, peaking in June when local police declared a riot, with smaller clashes occurring since then. In recent weeks, the protests typically drew a couple dozen people until the deployment was announced. Over the weekend, larger crowds gathered outside the facility and federal agents fired tear gas. Most violent crime around the U.S. has declined in recent years. In Portland, homicides from January through June decreased by 51% to 17 this year, compared with the same time period in 2024, data shows. In Chicago, homicides were down 31% to 278 through August, police shows. Since starting his second term, Trump has sent or talked about sending troops to 10 cities, including Baltimore, Memphis, Tennessee, the District of Columbia, New Orleans, and the California cities of Oakland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. A federal judge in September said the administration willfully broke federal law by deploying guard troops to Los Angeles over protests about immigration raids. From Tony Reed in Decatur, man gets 8 years on battery gun charges. Oscar M. McCurry II told a judge he heard evil voices in his head the day he went berserk and menaced police with a machete and a stolen cop shotgun before being shot and wounded by officers. Sentencing him to 8 years in prison Tuesday, presiding Macon County Circuit Court Judge Thomas Griffith told the 39-year-old defendant that he understood he has schizophrenia and mental health issues. But the judge also noted that McCurry has previously refused to take medication that could help him. And Griffith said the former California street gang member had gone on a one-day crime spree in central Illinois that was about as bad as it gets. The drama dates to the morning of May 3rd outside the P&V Quick Stop gas station in Macon. McCurry said the voices told him his children were being held captive and sexually assaulted in a semi-truck parked at the gas station, which he proceeded to ram with his own vehicle. The defendant told the court that he believed he had to die to free his children. McCurry was armed with a machete as arriving police confronted him before he ran onto the busy U.S. 51 highway while Macon County Sheriff's Office deputies blocked traffic to prevent a major accident. An arrest warrant described McCurry then taking the opportunity to steal an empty parked squad car and speed off northbound in the southbound lane, forcing one oncoming squad car into a ditch, almost ramming another. He then did ram a squad car, causing injury to an officer, but disabling the stolen police vehicle. McCurry then climbed out, clutching a police shotgun he had also stolen, and when he refused to drop the gun, police opened fire, wounding him. He still refused to drop the machete, but was eventually overpowered and arrested. Questioned by defense attorney Susan Moorhead, McCurry said he had considered making a not guilty because of insanity plea. But he said treatment in the Macon County Jail meant he was more coherent now and was willing to take responsibility for what he had done. He told Moorhead that his actions that day were not aimed at hurting anybody else but himself. "Were your actions that day an attempt to get the officers to kill you?" Moorhead asked. "Yes," McCurry replied. In a plea deal, he pleaded guilty to unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon, an aggravated battery. He was sentenced to 8 years on the weapons charge and another 5 on the battery offense, but the sentences were ordered run concurrently. McCurry had earlier apologized for his crimes and told the judge, "I would really like another chance, a fresh start." Moorhead said he was getting that now after consistently taking his medication and said he was willing to go to prison so he could continue doing that and getting better. She suggested a sentence of 3 years would be reasonable punishment. Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Scott Reuter, however, had argued for the 8-year sentence. He said that whatever McCurry's past history with illness and medication, he's still a danger to the community. sentencing the defendant and noting a previous criminal history that included assault with a deadly weapon, Griffith told him, "I don't know how anybody didn't get killed in this situation." Agreeing with Reuter's sentencing recommendation, Griffith added, "I'll be frank. If the state had recommended 10 years, Mr. McCurry, I would have given you 10 years. This is really about as bad as it gets." Macon County Sheriff Jim Root, who sat in the public gallery watching the court proceedings, said afterwards that he was okay with the length of the sentence. He said his officers frequently encountered people with mental health issues, and such issues were often associated with drug use. Root said at the end of the day, his officers just had to do the best they could with the circumstances they were confronted with. "All we care about is trying to protect the public from this type of behavior," he said. From our local and state news page, Faith, Chicago Heights. We have a photo of the Reverend Gary Graff kneeling to receive a blessing outside Pope Leo XIV's childhood home in Dalton, October 6th. Priest embarks on 50-day pilgrimage. Reverend Graff walking to New York to benefit Highlight Immigrant Children. From Evie Lewis, Daily Southtown, Tinley Park, Chicago. The Reverend Gary Graff, a Chicago Heights Catholic priest, began a 50-day pilgrimage Monday from Pope Leo's boyhood home in Dalton to New York to bring attention to the cause of immigrant children. Graff's planned destinations are Ellis Island, formerly the country's primary immigration processing center, and the Statue of Liberty, a national symbol of freedom. "There's no real path to citizenship for millions of people," Graff said. "The process is pretty much stagnant, and there's really no on-the-Google-map route from here to Ellis Island. You got to kind of create it." Graff said one reason he is undertaking the walk is because his own great-grandparents were immigrants who arrived through Ellis Island. "My great-grandparents, who came from County Cork and County Mayo, Ireland, and Stuttgart, Germany, their story isn't very dissimilar," Graff said. The present-day Ellis Island is now really our southern border. People come here with the same hopes and aspirations and desires and fears. He expects to arrive around Thanksgiving. To make the journey in the planned 50 days, he will need to walk around 18 to 20 miles a day. Graff is planning to undertake the walk largely alone, but said he's hoping others might join him along the way and take up parts of the walk in his stead so he can rest for periods of time. He plans to stop at churches and other places of worship along the way to meet with local faith and immigrant communities. The idea is to try to make connections and have those conversations along the way with some of those faith communities that they would literally take me in and allow me to spend the night, Graff said. Graff is the head pastor of Our Lady of the Heights in Chicago Heights and a member of the group Priests for Justice for Immigrants. Many who come to see him off were members of his congregation and others from the faith community who knew him from his history working for immigration justice. Sister Jean Keeley of the Dominican Order said she has been active in immigration work for about 20 years. For most of that time, she has been a member of a group that prays the rosary weekly for immigrants at the Broadview Immigration and Customs Enforcement Processing Center. "We've been praying there for 19 years for the safety of immigrants and that people who are in ICE treatment treat them respectfully. That has happened in the past, but it is definitely not happening right now," Keeley said. "They're grabbing people all over town in masks and no identification. No other police officer in the U.S. does that. It's like armed robbers." Graff's campaign is called Step Up, Speak Out. Graff and his supporters will track and document his journey and his interactions with the people he meets online, on social media, and on the website stepupspeakout.org. There will also be a donation page where people can donate for every step Graff takes. "You can donate for steps, every step," said spokesperson Lauren Foley. 100% of the proceeds of these donations go toward helping immigrant children who have been separated from their parents. Before his departure, supporters, community members, and faith leaders gathered to bless Graff and his journey. The Reverend Larry Dowling, moderator of Priests for Justice for Immigrants, opened the event. "Father Gary has spent his life walking with others," Dowling said. "This is not only a physical act of endurance, but a spiritual act of solidarity, a prayer in motion for the innocent victims of injustice in our world." One of the speakers was Imam Hassan Ali, a leader of the Chicago Muslim community who emphasized the interfaith nature of immigration justice work. "Today we gather as people of faith, all faiths and all traditions," Ali said. "We stand here at the beginning of this sacred journey, one that echoes the footsteps of all prophets and messengers and righteous people, men and women who walked for justice before us." Graff spoke about a time he walked from Mexico to Arizona across the Sonoran Desert, entering the country illegally as an act of protest. "An illegal act does not make someone illegal," Graff said. "If that were the case, how many of us who at any time in our lives have offended or violated or broken a law in this nation of laws would be in the same net now and be sent away?" Graff also read segments of the 1883 poem, The New Colossus, by Emma Lazarus, which is cast on a plaque at the base of the Statue of Liberty. The poem famously states, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." This is the message that we carry to Lady Liberty, the truth that all immigrants are not strangers, but rather our brothers, sisters, sons and daughters, Graff said. Deborah White, co-chaplain of the village of Dalton, was among several faith leaders at Graff's sending off. "What we're facing now in this country is inhumane, and it should not be happening," White said. "We are all created in God's image, and this is not his plan for his children." And so to have someone sitting in authority and dictating what's going on and treating people as though they're inhuman, that's not of God. White also said she is glad to see the faith community take up the Pope's childhood home as a site of importance, and she hopes to see more such events in Dalton. She said plans are underway to make the house a historic landmark and open it to the public. "Today is just a beginning of new things," White said. Now, part one from our opinion page. Our topic is All Rise for Big Rulings. Our first column is written by Hans von Spakovsky. He is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He wrote this for InsideSources.com. Tariffs, voting rights, girls' sports at stake. The Supreme Court recently refused to suspend a lower court decision telling South Carolina it has to allow a transgender student to use the boys' bathroom in a public school. This emphasizes the importance of issues the court will be reviewing as its new term begins this month. The court's last term featured significant issues ranging from nationwide injunctions to parental rights to religious liberty, and it delivered no shortage of important rulings. This new term looks no different. Here are a few of the most significant upcoming cases. Learning Resources versus Trump and Trump versus VOS Selections. Do we face an economic emergency due to our huge debilitating trade deficit and trade barriers imposed by other countries, as President Donald Trump claims? And does the president have the authority under applicable federal law to make that determination and impose tariffs unilaterally? That's the issue in these combined cases the Supreme Court recently accepted. They may affect everything from the authority of a president to the nation's economic well-being. West Virginia versus BPJ. Despite refusing to issue a stay on a lower court ruling allowing a transgender student to continue using the bathroom of their choice in South Carolina, the court did take this case from West Virginia, so it could decide the fate of women's sports in more than two dozen states. West Virginia's Save Women's Sports Act mandates that biological sex serve as the defining condition for participation in female sports. This was challenged by an 11-year-old who is biologically a boy yet claims to be a girl. In a decision defying common sense, the liberal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals enjoined the law, claiming that preventing this student from competing in girls' sports constituted sex-based discrimination. A ruling by the Supreme Court against West Virginia would be a disaster for the future of women's sports and for the safety and achievements of the women who participate in those sports. Louisiana versus Calais. Redistricting is an issue that often appears before the Supreme Court. After the 2020 census, Louisiana redrew its six congressional seats, creating a congressional district in which the majority of voters are black. The NAACP and others sued, claiming that given the size of the black population, the state's failure to create a second such district violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. A federal district judge agreed and ordered the state to draw a new map with two majority black districts. The state was then sued by other voters, claiming a violation of the Equal Protection Clause because the lines of the second district had been drawn based on race. A three-judge panel agreed. That decision was appealed to the Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments in March. Instead of issuing a decision at the end of its term in June, the court ordered a new round of arguments this fall on whether the state's intentional creation of a second majority black district violates the 14th or 15th Amendments. The outcome could influence redistricting nationwide. National Republican Senatorial Committee versus Federal Election Commission. This case examines the spending limits that federal law imposes on political parties engaging in candidate-coordinated campaign activities. This decision involves reconsidering a 2001 precedent in a case from Colorado. The National Republican Senatorial Committee and then Senator J.D. Vance filed a lawsuit claiming that such limits on the activities of political parties violate the First Amendment. The lower courts all ruled against them following the 2001 precedent. But the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit acknowledged a tension between 2001 decision and more recent decisions by the Supreme Court. This promises to be an eventful Supreme Court session. As these and other cases are being argued and decided, everyone from the president to the typical American could be affected by what happens. On October 10th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. and October 11th, 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Harvest to Home Fall Harvest Show will be held at the Illinois Amish Heritage Center, located between Arcola and Arthur on Route 133. Check their Facebook page and also IllinoisAmish.org. Demonstrations and attractions are both days. Fall harvest activities from yesteryear, horses, steam, and gas power, special feature oats threshing, powered by 10 horses, corn harvest, field pickers, and hand shucking, try your hand at corn shucking, check row plot, corn shelling and grinding into feed, grist mill making cornmeal, corn shocks, corn shredding for livestock bedding, apple butter and apple cider made while you watch, various old-time crafts, broom corn, broom making, rope making for children of all ages, sawmilling and buzzsaw, horseshoeing, experienced farrier show how it's done. Children's activities include a petting zoo, horse and buggy and pony and cart rides. Food and beverage is available, kettle corn, homemade ice cream. There will be, on Saturday from 7 to 10 a.m., a pancake, sausage, and liverwurst breakfast. Admission price is $10 per adult, children under 12 free. From our food page today, we have recipes for apple cider beef stew, an article, Three Ways to Enjoy Apple Cider Without Drinking It. Apple cider is perhaps the most quintessential of cold fall drinks, whether it comes in a plastic jug from your local apple farmer or has been fermented into the hard stuff. Also wonderful when heated up on the stove and mulled with warm spices such as cinnamon, cloves, and allspice, and a hint of citrus. A splash of rum or bourbon is optional. But you can do so much more. Everything from cookies and cakes to donuts and sweetbreads. Here's the three recipes meant to help you enjoy fall cider in new and flavorful ways. Our second and third recipe are cider-glazed root vegetables with apple and tarragon, and glazed apple cider cake. For the complete recipes and ingredient lists, see the in-print version of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, October 8th. In part two of Decatur's Herald and Review for October 8th, we'll continue with the death notices, our opinion page, and other local, state, and federal news. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, October 8th. Please stay tuned.